These lectures are part of the Great Courses on Tape series. The Great Courses on Tape cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. The lectures on these tapes are titled No Excuses, Existentialism, and the Meaning of Life. The lecturer is Professor Robert Solomon. Professor Solomon received his undergraduate degree in molecular biology from the University of Pennsylvania and his master's and doctoral degrees in philosophy and psychology from the University of Michigan. He has taught at Princeton and the University of Pittsburgh and is now the Quincy Lee Centennial Professor of Philosophy at the University of Texas at Austin. Professor Solomon has been awarded the Standard Oil Outstanding Teaching Award and the President's Associates Teaching Award. He has published dozens of articles and more than a dozen books in philosophy and psychology. Each of Dr. Solomon's lectures is outlined in the course guide that comes with these tapes. The course guide also includes a glossary, timeline, biographical notes, and bibliography. You may find it useful to review the outlines before and after listening to the lectures. Lecture 13, Nietzsche, the Übermensch, and the Will to Power.
In this, the last lecture on Nietzsche, I'd like to talk about two of his most famous and most notorious notions, the notion of the Übermensch, the superman or overman, and his idea about the will to power. The Übermensch, I'm convinced, is famous largely because of a play that George Bernard Shaw wrote parodying the notion called Man and Superman. It was a comedy and very successful. The fact is that the Übermensch really just appears in one book of Nietzsche and by no means in the whole book, and that's at the beginning of Thus Spoke Zarathustra. Nevertheless, Nietzsche speaks of higher men all the way through his work, and the distinction between higher and lower is something which is absolutely essential to his thought. Zarathustra talks about the possibility of the Übermensch. He often talks as if the Übermensch is an evolutionary step. He says at one point, following Darwin, man is a bridge between the ape and the Übermensch. There are many ways of understanding this, but I think for our purposes now, we should mention that Nietzsche's relationship to Darwin, in fact, is very complicated. He was clearly under Darwin's thrall in many ways. I pointed out a few lectures ago that in his epistemology, his views of truth, he had a view which was very much a kind of pragmatized form of Darwin's evolutionary theory. Nevertheless, with regard to Darwin as a whole, I think he took him to be much too much in the tradition of looking at man as the highest accomplishment of evolution. Probably not true of Darwin. He also saw Darwin as taking the thesis that survival of the fittest meant that the best survive. Whereas what Nietzsche is very concerned about is the idea that if you look at evolution, it's not necessarily the best that survive at all. There was a theory that was circulating a few years ago, courtesy of the novelist Tom Robbins, that said basically that the final stage in evolution, the last two creatures to fight it out, will be the cockroach and the gonorrhea bacillus. The idea is that basically evolution gives no guarantees of giving us the better. So I think we should look at Nietzsche's and Zarathustra's promise of the Übermensch as a mere possibility, something to aspire for, something to dream about. As evidence for this, in the same speech where he talks about the Übermensch trying to turn on the townspeople and get them excited about this possibility of overcoming themselves and becoming more than they are, he introduces another character called the last man, where the idea is to get people truly disgusted with themselves and to see that this is another possibility for evolution, another way that we might turn out. And in fact, it's a way that is very close to the way we are. The last man is the ultimate bourgeois consumer, the ultimate couch potato. He, she is a person who has no aspirations, is merely content, comfortable, satisfied. As Nietzsche puts it sarcastically, the last man says, "We have invented happiness," and blinks. The blink being, on the one hand, a sign of idiocy, on the other, a sign of just not wanting to see what life is really like. So, two possibilities. The Übermensch, which clearly Nietzsche portrays as an ideal, and the last man, which is a kind of counter-ideal. In fact, precisely the ideal that would be defended by a great many utilitarians as the best that we could possibly have. To understand the Übermensch, I think we should go back to the discussion of master morality and slave morality. Because when Nietzsche talks about master and slave morality, what he distinguishes there is strength and weakness. The difference is primarily one of power and also of independence. The master assumes his power. He assumes his abilities. And he aspires to excellence. He also does this in an important sense alone. Not that he doesn't have friends and allies, but there's a sense in which the values, the talents, the ideals that he pursues are very much his own. Slave morality, by contrast, is a morality of the weak. The slave is very concerned with what other people think. The slave is very concerned about not being different. The slave is very concerned, and primarily concerned, with defense, with protecting himself from those who are stronger. So the picture of slave morality that Nietzsche gives us, which he sometimes also calls herd morality, is of lots of weak people, most of us in fact, herding together for self-protection. What characterizes us as slaves is weakness. And weakness not necessarily physically, and not necessarily just in terms of our status in society, but Nietzsche makes it very clear that there's a sense in which weakness of spirit, weakness of soul, weakness of will is what it's really all about. The relationship between the master and the slave, consequently, looks something like this. The master is independent and powerful. The slave is relatively powerless and consequently resentful. And as we saw, slave morality is basically a reaction against master morality. Now, one way to understand the Übermensch is to understand the Übermensch as a version of master morality. Or, as I ended one of the previous lectures, we might say that the Übermensch is master morality spiritualized by 2,000 years of slave morality and its self-discipline. To characterize the Übermensch in this sense, we might say, first of all, in contrast with slave morality, the Übermensch is free of resentment. In fact, some of my colleagues would even define the Übermensch as a character who is so free of regret and resentment that he can fully and enthusiastically endorse that thought experiment we called eternal recurrence. Would you like your life lived over and over and over again exactly the same? The Übermensch is someone who can say with no hesitation whatsoever, "Yes, gladly I would accept this." But the idea of the Übermensch as a step in evolution raises a number of problems for Nietzsche. Because first of all, as I said, it is by no means guaranteed that this is what we're going to become. But secondly, it is impossible for him, in some of the things he says, for us to become really anything. And this goes back to the kind of biological determinism I talked about in the previous lecture. There's a sense in which we are born as the creatures we are. We are born with our boundaries, limits, and the consequence is that what we become is, in fact, just ourselves. So, when it comes to aspiring to be the Übermensch, one might say that for Nietzsche, this is absolutely implausible. One can't become something so much more than one is. The Übermensch, it really is just a way of our looking at ourselves and seeing that we're really not so hot as we often think we are. He often makes enormous fun of those who would call for the improvement of man. And of course, here he's talking not just about Christians and the kind of transformation that Christianity is supposed to bring about, but also he's talking about the social movements of his day, and socialism in particular. We can think to our own century and all the horrors that have been imposed upon people by societies that have tried to change them from selfish, egoistic, capitalist to something more socialistic, more egalitarian, and so on. One thinks, for example, of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, and one is horrified. But Nietzsche would say, of course you can't change people in that sense. People are as they are, and what we have to do is work within the realm of what we are. So it's implausible to say that we can aspire to be and work towards being an Übermensch, but nevertheless, he continuously distinguishes in his philosophy between those who are higher and those who are lower. And higher and lower here typically refer to the will to power, something I want to talk about in some detail in a moment. But before we think that power here refers just to a kind of aristocratic status and just to a kind of military prowess, which in the ancient world that Nietzsche admired certainly would be the case, I think it's important to point out that the person who emerges as the higher example of human being in Nietzsche's works, more often than any other, is the German poet Goethe. Goethe was, he says, someone who exercised all of his talents, who created himself as a unified human being on the basis of them. Goethe also fit the role as somebody who, in Nietzsche's terms, experimented with his life. At various points in his life, he was a civil servant, he was a lawyer, he was a poet, he was a playwright. Within the scope of his writing, he tried many different styles, and of course his works are voluminous. He was a passionate man and had a rather intricate social life. In other words, he was just the sort of person who explored the limits, who exercised his talents to the maximum, that Nietzsche really admires. So when we talk about the Übermensch, when we talk about higher and lower, when we talk about the will to power, I think it's very important to keep in mind that what Nietzsche is ultimately concerned with is creativity, with a kind of spiritual life, and not simply a world of power, as that phrase might seem. The notion of the will to power itself is problematic. It's a phrase Nietzsche discovered early on, and he really fell in love with it. And we all know how this can work. You fall in love with a phrase and you keep using it, but its meaning keeps changing and it often carries with it connotations that you really just as soon do away with. To be very particular about this, the notion of the will to power is, in a way, directly borrowed from Schopenhauer, Nietzsche's mentor. But Nietzsche rejects Schopenhauer, and he rejects him rather thoroughly as a pessimist, and he rejects his metaphysics. In particular, the will to power is derived from Schopenhauer's notion of the will, where the will refers to the thing in itself, reality in itself, what's behind all the appearances of the world. But as we saw, Nietzsche rejects that very distinction between appearance and reality, and the idea of a core reality and a reality behind the scenes is something that he utterly rejected. So the notion of will in Schopenhauer is one of the first things to go in his rejection to Schopenhauer, and I would argue that perhaps the will to power should go with it, but it doesn't. Second, the notion of power itself. Power itself is not military power. The word Nietzsche uses here is the word Macht, not Reich. Power is very often the power of thought, the power of the imagination, the power of creativity. There's a sense in which what we're really talking about is not so much power over other people as self-mastery. And Nietzsche, despite his attack on asceticism and slave morality, makes self-mastery one of the centerpieces of his entire philosophy. It applies to the masters also, but there's a sense in which here it is much less desperate. The idea is that masters also master themselves in their pursuit of excellence. but there's a sense in which the discipline of slave morality, which really has allowed us to deny ourselves and, in a way, shape ourselves in ways which we can aspire to. And here, too, we see that tension in Nietzsche between the extent to which we are self-realizing and we are capable of self-mastery, and the extent to which, in some sense, we are the product and the victim of the way we are brought up, our genes, and so on. Schopenhauer took the will to be metaphysical. Nietzsche, of course, rejects metaphysics and rejects that notion of the will to power. I think a better interpretation, although Nietzsche occasionally falls into the idea of talking about the will to power at the basis of everything, but a much better interpretation, and one that fits his theory, I think, in a more sympathetic way, is that the will to power really is a kind of slogan covering a theory of motivation. Here, too, Nietzsche gets ambiguous. There's a sense in which he sometimes thinks about this theory as universal and covering everything, and he sometimes talks about the animal kingdom as well as all human behavior as motivated by the will to power. When he's in his more modest moods, and I think the more reasonable mood, and that is to talk about the will to power as a very particular kind of motivation, one that motivates a great many human behaviors, and leaving aside for a moment the animal kingdom. Basically, the idea is that what motivates us is a drive to feel powerful. And there's an ambiguity here, too, because Nietzsche sometimes talks about the will to having power, and sometimes he talks about the importance of the feeling of power. And while we can see how these two might fit together, they're certainly very different. One can be very powerful without knowing it, and one can have the feeling of great power, and the feeling might be an illusion. But the idea is that what we act for the most part, is power. How should we understand this? Well, I think the first way to do it is to oppose it to its most obvious motivational rival, and that is hedonism, the idea that people act for the sake of pleasure or for the avoidance of pain. In the utilitarians, who are more or less his exact contemporaries, this theory that we act for pleasure and to avoid pain is absolutely the centerpiece of their philosophy, its first premise, if you like. The idea is that you can understand human behavior by understanding what people enjoy, what they don't enjoy, what gives them pain, and then look at their behavior as a kind of means-ends strategy to achieving the most pleasure and avoiding pain. And Nietzsche wants to say, nonsense. Look at how people behave. To be sure, sometimes they act for pleasure, and sometimes they act in a delayed way for gratification at the ends of some means-end causal continuum. But the truth is, most people don't act for pleasure. They act for all sorts of reasons. And the ones that Nietzsche wants to highlight are those which he would call power. When I think about how to understand power here, I think maybe the best way to take it is something very close to what we call self-esteem. Now, that's a fairly limp notion, perhaps because it's been around California too long. But the basic idea is that self-esteem is not just feeling good about yourself, but it's being energized by your own ideas and energized by your own desires and energized by your own talents. Self-esteem isn't just a kind of superficial feeling about yourself. And it certainly isn't just a matter of standing in front of the mirror in the morning and doing some affirmations. But rather, self-esteem can be taken as a very deep notion in which what you do is you think of yourself as confident, and you think of yourself as capable, and you think of yourself in terms of your ideals. And what Nietzsche says is, if you watch human behavior, what you will see is that a great deal of our behavior can be much better characterized as the will to power in this sense, rather than as the pursuit of pleasure, avoidance of pain. Take, for example, the idea of, say, the ancient martyrs, early Christians, who allowed themselves to be persecuted in the name of their faith. You have to really stretch to come up with any theory that says this is for the sake of pleasure and the avoidance of pain. One can, of course, bring in the theological picture and say, well, they're willing to take an awful lot of pain in the short term for an infinite amount of bliss in the long term. But that's not very convincing. Even if they believed that, there's a sense in which what motivated them was something much more powerful than the promise of eternal pleasure in the future. What motivated them was, first of all, the sense that they were right and righteous, the sense that they were standing for a cause that was much more important than their mere individual lives could possibly represent. Think of the way our students behave. I often ask them, why are you taking this class? And of course they flatter me and say it's because we enjoy it and all that. And I say, no. I'm glad that's true, but why are you taking this class? And inevitably, if we sort of trace the chain of reasons, it has something to do with how they think about themselves, what their ultimate aspirations are. And while there's a kind of limp story about this will make me happy at the end of it, nevertheless, it's very clear that what motivates them is something much more powerful, and that's their notion of themselves. In short, the idea is that the will to power is a theory, and it's a theory about what moves us, and it often, in Nietzsche's language, takes us into some of the really gory details of human self-deception and hypocrisy. Talking about Christianity, for example, he says that a great deal of what Christian psychology talks about, for example, loving thy neighbor and having compassion and pity for those who are worse off than yourself, really is a kind of hidden screen for motivation that is much more vicious. What is often called love, in fact, is a kind of contempt. And love in the more romantic sense, which we celebrate as perhaps the most selfless of all emotions. Nietzsche wants to say it's not selfless at all. When you come right down to it, what we call romantic love is really possession, power straight and simple. Pity, an emotion which is much praised through history, particularly in the Christian tradition. He wants to say we think of it in terms of simply feeling sorry for someone who is worse off. In fact, when you think about pity, what you come to understand very quickly is that it is the kind of smugness of superiority. It is feeling higher, more powerful, more fortunate than this other person. One might also note that pity can give one a certain sense of pleasure, better him than me. But nevertheless, even the sense of pleasure, note that it follows from the sense of power and superiority. It is not itself the goal. So there's a picture that Nietzsche has, which he pursues in many details, and I would argue that the real interest is in the details and the kinds of psychological analyses he gives us. But the idea is that the will to power is a theory of human behavior, which, whether or not it covers all cases, covers more than enough cases to make it a very plausible and very often dominant theory about what makes us tick. One can think of the will to power in another way. And I think this is something that also permeates Nietzsche's philosophy. And it doesn't really have to do with motivation at all. And it's certainly not metaphysics. It's the will to power as a kind of celebration. The will to power in particular as a celebration of what I call the passionate life. If you think back over the history of philosophy, both East and West, in fact, what you find is an overwhelming amount of emphasis on freedom from the emotions, and the idea is that emotions enslave us, and rather a life of reason, a life of contemplation. And philosophers since ancient times have often talked about the importance of peace of mind and tranquility, and what at one point was called apatheia, which is sort of translated in our current term, apathy, which doesn't mean just not caring, but what it means is being free from the enslavement of passion. For Nietzsche, as for Kierkegaard, there is a very powerful view to the contrary. Namely, what makes life meaningful is passion. A life without passion would be essentially meaningless. Some of the ancient Stoics used to say, we should live our life without attachments. The idea was to make us invulnerable to fortune and fate. The less you are attached to, whether it's people you love or things that you own, or positions that you hold, the less than anyone can take away from you. And ultimately, you can reduce yourself to the point where all you can lose is your life, but having removed other attachments, even that is no big loss. This is the height of what Nietzsche calls slave morality. It's not an accident that at least some of the ancient Stoics were slaves, although I should add one of them at least was a Roman emperor. But the idea is this whole thought about cutting attachments, cutting your losses, is exactly the kind of defensiveness that characterizes slave morality. By contrast, what Nietzsche wants to say is, attachments are what life is all about. Attachments to people, perhaps. Nietzsche himself was not big on relationships. But attachments to ideals, attachments to aspirations, attachments to works, works of art, your own creativity, that is absolutely essential. And so, against the general trend in philosophy to praise a kind of meekness, to praise a kind of withdrawal, to praise a kind of emotional absence, what Nietzsche wants to say is, life is passion. One of the things we might note is that throughout Nietzsche's works, there's a metaphor of energy that permeates much of his works. Now, one should say that in terms of the history of science, the notion of energy was a kind of new arrival. There was some semblance of concepts of energy in earlier centuries, but it's only really in the 19th century that the notion of energy comes to hold the central place in physics. Before that, for example, people talked about matter in motion and talked about inertia and momentum and so on. But the idea of energy as something which was distinctive in its own right was something that was fairly new. And as I mentioned in the first lecture, Nietzsche was by no means antiposed to science, but rather he looked at science as the source of some great ideas. Well, this notion of energy was what he wanted to pick up as a kind of metaphor for human life too. What the human soul, the human psyche operates with is energy. And not far to see that Freud picks up the same metaphor and makes it quite literally the centerpiece of his early psychodynamics. But thinking of energy now, not as a physical notion, but as something very much key to human life, one thinks of a life of excitement and adventure. One thinks of, especially, the kinds of adventures that give rise to the grand passions. And Nietzsche here wants to say, along with Kierkegaard, that it's the passionate life and passionate commitment and passionately throwing yourself into what you do that makes life worthwhile. But let's be very careful here. Not every passion is desirable, and when Nietzsche defends the passionate life, he's not saying any passion at all is okay. Some passions are what he calls life-stultifying, and one can take as a primary example the passion of resentment. Resentment is the passion that defines slave morality and the life of slaves. Resentment is a passion which, on the one hand, is rather brilliant. It can even be creative. But the very notion of resentment suggests someone who is very low in self-esteem, someone who is putting themselves down, someone who is unwilling to be constructively creative because their life is tied up in this kind of simmering derogation of someone whom they hold responsible for their problems. What Nietzsche is concerned with are the grand passions. It was the philosopher Hegel, whom Nietzsche often puts down, who said nothing great is ever done without passion. It's often ignored the fact that Kant said something very similar earlier. But for Nietzsche, this becomes the very centerpiece of his philosophy, not kind of a side slogan. Love, for instance, is absolutely essential. And again, it's not necessarily romantic love, which Nietzsche was inexperienced at, didn't do very well with, and, well, he didn't think it was very important. But rather, it's the kind of love, for example, that he had for the ancient Greeks, the kind of love that he had for the future of perhaps not mankind, but the possibilities of evolution, the Übermensch. And it was certainly the passion he had, and he shows in his own work. No one writes more passionately than Nietzsche. No one uses more exclamation points. There's a sense in which what Nietzsche takes life to be is, in fact, manifested in his work. He also says that there is really no distinction, no dichotomy, as philosophers have often argued, between reason and passion. This goes back all the way to Plato, at least. And Plato, Nietzsche says, turned his reason into a tyrant precisely in order to keep his passions under control. Passions have often been conceived of in a sort of animalistic, bestial way, as if they are foreign forces trying to take over. Freud notably referred to the passions in general as the it, the id. But there's a sense in which, as Nietzsche points out, Every passion has its own quantum of reason. Passions are not simply irrational forces from our animal nature. Rather, passions are themselves forms of insight, ways of understanding the world, ways of orienting or gearing ourselves to our lives. And this ultimately is what's important for Nietzsche. As opposed to life stultifying passions like resentment, he praises the life-enhancing passions like love. And ultimately, it's the love of life itself, which is his highest ideal. Life affirmation, and that means not appealing to another world, a Christian heaven, or a future state of affairs in society, but simply accepting your life as your life and loving it, that is the highest virtue. This is where eternal occurrence fits into his philosophy. It is the test. How do you feel about your life? Are you capable of affirming your life in such a way that you would repeat it exactly as is an infinite number of times? The opposition here is his teacher, Schopenhauer, who of course said, looking at life, much less thinking about it as repeating an endless number of times, what you come up with is a conclusion that it amounts to nothing. But in Nietzsche's existential test, what we come to see is the possibility of a very different picture, that we can look at our lives and look at the sorts of things he's been talking about, even our own limitations, and say, yes, this is what I want, even an infinite times more.